Good morning and welcome to The Business of Living, the show that brings you strategies and practical solutions for managing your life and career. I'm your host, Scott Ventrella. Well, everybody, and I mean everybody's talking about the economy, and just I don't think anybody can make any kind of sense. I'm not an economist. I did take economics back in college. That was a long, long time ago. I only really remember two things, supply and demand. But the one thing that I do pick up on is that nothing seems to make any kind of sense relative to some of the key indicators. And I'm not going to talk about that, actually, which is why I'm so pleased to have our guest this morning, Nick Perna. Nick is an economist. He graduated from Boston College and has a PhD in economics from MIT. In 1999, he founded Perna Associates, specializing in economic analysis, forecasting, and strategy. Within the past several years, Nick has appeared numerous times on the PBS NewsHour and other local and national news broadcasts. He is frequently quoted in the national and regional press. The Wall Street Journal and Business Week have both cited him as one of the top economic forecasters in the United States. Nick, welcome.
Wow, I love that introduction, Scott. Could you read it?
It's a huge buildup, but you know, I'm gonna just use shorthand right now. I think of you because we've known each other now for a few years, and what I really love about you is that I think of you as the everyman's economist.
Yeah, that's a great way of putting how I like to come across, which is to take complicated stuff and not make it simple, but make it understandable to real people, to relate it to the way they're thinking and what they're worrying about.
I think, you know, many people, we hear about the economy, we use and we understand some of the jargon. I think what's often missing is in the translation. So what does it mean to me? What does it mean to me relative to my family? What does it mean to me relative to my career? What does it mean to me relative to important financial decisions I may have to make, et cetera? So I think that most of us struggle with that is, okay, I'm hearing the news, I'm seeing the news, I'm looking at the indicators. I don't know how that's going to translate for me.
Yeah, I mentioned to you previously that I went to a luncheon recently where one of my graduate school professors spoke, and he's a Nobel Prize winner in economics. And someone raised their hand and said that they really didn't do very well in economics, but wanted to ask a question. And he said, if you didn't do well, it was because it was badly taught, which I thought was a very interesting comment coming from a guy who was a spectacular teacher. So he had, I think if anything, his knack for trying to understand this stuff and put it across kind of rubbed off on me. But go ahead.
So, no, that's okay. So let's just take it maybe from the top. When we think about economics and economic indicators, you know, what's going on right now? What's your sense? What's your take on things? And what should we as consumers, and again, we as people who maybe are, you know, supporting our families, et cetera, what should we be doing or how should we be thinking about this?
Sure, that's a great question because there's no one soundbite answer to it, but there are ways of answering it that I think are relevant. For example, the recession ended 2.5 years ago. Well, ended simply means that the gross domestic product stopped declining, Scott, okay? Mm-hmm. It didn't mean that we got back to normal, and in many cases, we're not back to normal. So if you look at a couple of big things like the stock market, the Dow Jones Industrial Average, that's probably 85% back to normal, okay? Right. It regained better than 3/4 of the ground that it lost. At the other end of the spectrum, which is much more important for you, me, and your listeners, is that we've only gotten back about 40% of the jobs that we lost, okay? So there's this kind of dichotomy between Wall Street and Main Street. And if you look at house prices, another thing that's very dear to our hearts, house prices nationally, depends on which indicator you use, but they're down about 30-35%. And so there's been small recovery in jobs, or modest recovery, and no recovery overall in house prices, yet the economy is supposedly in a recovery phase, but that's in terms of that things are moving forward, but at a plodding pace.
So is this? It sounds like a mixed bag. I don't know whether to be cautiously optimistic or should I, start burying gold in my backyard.
Yeah, I think you should be cautiously optimistic. I mean, it could have been a lot worse. We went through the worst recession since World War II, in fact, the worst since the Great Depression, and we managed to get out of it. And one of the reasons why it's taking us such a long time is because the research says that recessions caused by major financial crises take a long time to heal. Okay, one of the really good spots out there is inflation. You know, there were people several years back when the Fed was... Federal Reserve was taking all kinds of extraordinary steps to keep us afloat, who were saying that we were going to be facing inflation like we'd never had before. Well, you know, we're facing inflation like not too bad. You know, including gasoline prices, the consumer price index is up only about 3% over the last 12 months.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that you mentioned gasoline because that's something that, you know, it's in our face every single day. And
yes.
And for the layperson, and I'm in that category, that's essentially how I'm measuring it. My gosh, on Saturday, my teenage daughter is now driving. We've got that car to fill up. We've got my wife's car and we've got my car. So filling up those three cars, they were about $60 per car, $180 day for gasoline. Now my daughter doesn't drive that much. It'll last maybe a couple of weeks. My point is, I'm just thinking, because I was the one that filled up all three cars, $180 just like that. And just driving into the studio today, I'm seeing gas getting closer and closer to that. And I've never seen this before, close to the $5 mark. That's a scary thing. So that's I know it's interesting to hear you say that inflation really hasn't been that bad.
Yeah, but it has been for some things.
I think for some things, okay.
Yeah, and that's where we want to kind of not, I read a book recently which I loved. It was about the mafia, and there was this guy in it who was the master of malaprops, and he said you shouldn't throw the baby out with the bathtub, okay?
Right.
So don't throw the baby out with the bathtub with this one. In other words, there is a lot of inflation for gasoline, okay? But there's not a lot of inflation for natural gas. Okay, so if you look, there are things in the consumer price index, which is meant to mirror what the average American consumer buys. So it's got in it things like the cost of living. So it's got cost of housing, which is like 40% of the consumer price index. If you throw in cost of home ownership as well as operation, and that's not up an awful lot. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
If you throw in things that, your daughters are probably into, video entertainment and all the electronics that we keep buying,
right.
All that stuff is actually down in price over
absolutely.
The last year.
You know? Absolutely.
And yet we don't buy, you don't buy a new iPhone every day. You do buy gasoline every day. And I think another thing that makes it stand out is, you pay your monthly mortgage by check, okay, or your wife Catherine pays it by check each month. But then,
how did you know if she took care of the? We know who wears the pants in my family.
Right, exactly. but there's a certain amount of walking around money that we all have, or that we think of, which is our cash outlays for gasoline. Maybe we use credit cards, but it's still different than the way we think of the monthly payments, okay? And most of the monthly payments are fixed, see? So they're sort of out of our mind, and we make them once a month. So we tend to exaggerate how important gasoline prices are. Now, having said that, you wouldn't be an economist if you didn't say, having said that, or on the one hand or on the other hand,
right.
It is a drain on purchasing power, okay? One of the things that keeps the economy from going at a faster pace is that a big chunk of discretionary income is being siphoned off, literally and figuratively, to pay for not just gasoline, but I heat my house. We both live in Ridgefield. I heat my house with home heating oil, and my gosh, that was another shocker. I, in my wisdom, chose not to take the fixed price contract, being as smart as I am. but then, I think, again, overall, inflation of about 3%, which is sort of moderate, if you understand how the consumer price index is put together. And maybe even better if you take out food and energy. Now, we don't take them out because we don't believe they're important. We take them out because we want to see what's going on with the three-quarters of the cost of living that is not brought to you by OPEC, weather, stuff like that. And that's up only about 2% over the last year. So the reason why that's all this is good is because it keeps Mr. Bernanke from raising interest rates, okay?
And from what at least I read, sounds like they're going to start creeping up. Is that correct?
It's interesting. Mr. Bernanke, who I think has done a really pretty good job under very dire adverse circumstances,
mm-hmm.
he's pledged to keep short-term rates. Now, the Fed controls something called the Fed funds rate, but that's not important. What's important is that the Fed funds rate determines all short-term interest rates. So, you know, one-year certificates of deposit, all that stuff. And he's pledged to keep them very low for at least another couple of years. Okay. Meanwhile, though, longer-term rates, which he doesn't control directly, those are determined in global financial markets. They've been creeping up, but they're still incredibly low. Look at a fixed-rate mortgage, for example.
Does a Bernanke have that much influence, that much power? I know, you know, when things go bad, we're always looking for a whipping boy, right? I think there have already been calls for his resignation. But
right.
is that much power? You know, does that?
Yeah,
much
I mean,
power
look, at it, look at it this way. I mean, yeah. Two things. One of them is. The Fed is able to say it wants close to zero short-term interest rates, and voila, it gets them. Okay,
mm-hmm.
Much to our chagrin, because you can't get anything on a 1 or 2 year certificate of deposit these days. The other thing is that it had the power. My way of looking at it as a professional economist to stave off the collapse of the financial system by, you know, things like quantitative easing. I won't go into that, but many extraordinary measures that Bernanke, who's a student of the Great Depression, was able to effectively implement.
Now, just shifting over to the unemployment situation, and the numbers are slowly creeping back up. I'm not sure it's that much comfort to either A, the number of kids who will be graduating from college in about a month's time, or
yeah.
B, those people who are either out of work or people who have been out of work for quite a long time. What are the prospects? And I'm wondering, you know, it could be different for those two very particular groups.
Yeah.
Those that have been more senior in the workplace,
and then more junior.
What are the prospects in the next, let's say, 6 months to a year out?
That's a great question. First of all, you know, we have had progress. The unemployment rate peaked at something like 10% 2 years ago,
mm-hmm.
and it's now down to like I think 8.3 now. There's also been job growth, depending on what measure of last year, for example, of somewhere around 2 to 2.5 million net new jobs in the United States. So a large portion of that decline reflects improved employment. A small portion of it reflects the fact that the labor force isn't growing as rapidly because people are standing on the sidelines saying, why should I be looking when I don't think I can get a job, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but most of the improvement is real. Now, you hit two really soft points. It's a tough market for young people. And we went through this before, back in the early 90s, you know, the recession was much more regional in nature. It was New England. But young New Englanders were hard-pressed. You know, we had kids when I was working at one of the large banks who would come in and say, I'll do anything. I will work as a, I'll do filing. This is somebody with a bachelor's degree. I'll do filing just to get my foot in the door. And I think it's a bit like that. But, you know, barring a collapse in Europe, which now doesn't seem likely, or barring some chaos in the Middle East, which we never know about, I think that, you know, the job market will gradually improve, especially for the young people. It's harder for the older folks, though, the ones who've been out of work for a while. The young people have fresher skills. They're cheaper. You know, their medical, if you still give out medical benefits, they don't get sick as often. Okay?
Right, yeah.
You know, so all the reasons, so it's easier. I think that relief will come to young people before it does to the longer-term unemployed, which for me means that there's a role there for government to play. You know, I don't quite know how. That's a whole program, if you want. But you know, we need to do something about these people. Just saying that, you know, nature doesn't take care of itself in this sense.
Now, another very interesting phenomenon is that more people now have to push out retirement. So either they're pushing out retirement or they've been retired and now have to re-enter the workforce. Now, depending on the business, the type of business, some employers actually like that. Things that I have heard and read suggest that they're more reliable, you know, less fickle. They don't necessarily need all of the perks, et cetera, et cetera. Is there any truth to that? And does that interfere with somebody's ability then to – are we now competing with these people pushing out retirement or coming back from retirement?
Yeah, I think, first of all, it shows up in the data. If you look, there has not been a shrinkage of the older workforce. Okay, you would think that they would be retiring. Well, they're doing exactly what you're saying. Many of them staying on, many of them trying to stay on in full time positions, many in part time positions. Now, is it competing? You know, I suppose to a degree, especially for the people who are long term unemployed, and maybe even for some of the young people.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, in the past, it used to be a lot of people would work. A lot of guys would say, I like to work so I can get out of the house, get out from under with my wife's feet, and have some walking around money. Okay,
right.
But that was when working was discretionary, and you might be able to find a part-time job, and employers loved it because usually you had your own benefits. Now it's more necessary. People either saw their 401ks get depleted because we no longer, most people don't have those defined benefit pension plans, you know, the ones that guaranteed you a certain amount per year. And if you were really lucky, you got a cost of living increase. No, most people don't have those. So, yeah, we've got a lot of, if you're an employer, Scott, you can view this as an opportunity to get skilled, reliable people. And if you're out of work, you look at it as competition.
This is, of course, related, but switching gears just slightly. Of course, I'll mention my daughter again, who's a senior in high school, and she came home the other day and said, whichever teacher, maybe political science, but she came home all in a huff. Like she said, you know, Social Security is going to be gone by 2040. And essentially she was railing on about the fact that, you know, here we are, you know, we're going to be putting money into something that we're never even going to see a penny of it. Is there any truth to that?
Well, you know, anything can happen. And I think one of the arguments against kicking the can down the road, which is a favorite expression you're seeing about Washington, postpone any hard decision.
Right.
You know,
yeah, got it.
And you know, Social Security is the relatively easy one to fix up compared to Medicare. Okay, and Social Security, if what you do is you raise the retirement age further, tack a bit on to Social Security taxes. They don't have to be draconian increases, and then maybe nip away at the annual cost of living increase for Social Security. See, the Social Security checks go up by the full amount of the consumer price index every year. And that gets to be expensive, okay? I happen to like it because I get those. I'm a retiree. but maybe what you could do is say, let's subtract a percentage point out first. So if the inflation rate's 3, you're only going to get 2. That can save tons of money. So I think Social Security need not be in as dire straits as your daughter thinks, but it requires some actions on the part of the Congress to deal with it. Medicare is in much more serious straits. But even there, you know, the Congress can deal with it. So none of this stuff is inevitable. It's only inevitable if we keep going on with the kind of gridlock we've seen over the last year or two.
Okay. And when you say gridlock, is that, you know, relative to the politics?
Yeah, that's what I mean. In other words, reluctant. Neither side wants to budge an inch. And so what you get is grudging extensions of things like the payroll tax reduction that was enacted a year or so ago, and even of tax cuts, you know, even of the debt ceiling. We almost brought the government to a grinding halt. They almost brought the government to a grinding halt, Scott. And so, this is not a healthy situation. Gridlock can be good if it keeps them from doing bad things, but it can be bad if it keeps them from doing the things that we need to have them do.
Okay, well, lots to think about, and it is somewhat encouraging saying that, you know, we could re-script this. You know, it's dangerous, I think, to make any premature or foregone conclusions, because things can and do change, and they can and do change, and hopefully will change for the better. We're going to continue with our discussion with Nick Perna, economist. I like to think of him as every man's economist. When we return, we'll come back and talk. Nick, I'd like to talk a little bit about the cost of education, which seems to be going through the roof. Many people also, and I'm in this category, thinking about, okay, now how are we going to fund our child's college education? When we come back, you're listening to The Business of Living here at 1490 WGCH.
My name is Erica, and I swim for my best friend, Brooke.
Hi, I'm Paige, and I swim for my sister.
My name's Julie, and I'm swimming for my uncle.
Hi, my name is Brooke, and I'm swimming for myself.
My name is Nina, and I swim for my friend's mom.
The 6th annual Swim Across America Greenwich to Stanford Swim takes place Saturday, June 30th, and is making waves in the fight against cancer. Come join the fun and swim with Olympic, professional, and recreational swimmers in Long Island Sound. Swimmers of all ages and abilities are welcome. Boaters, kayakers, and land volunteers are welcome, too. 100% of all funds raised by the annual Swim Across America event go towards cancer research through the Alliance for Cancer Gene Therapy, the nation's only nonprofit dedicated exclusively to funding innovative cancer gene therapy research. Swim Across America Greenwich to Stanford Swim takes place Saturday, June 30th. To register, visit www.swimacrossamerica.org and click on the Greenwich Stanford Swim link.
We swim for a cure!
Welcome back. You're listening to The Business of Living, the show that brings you strategies and practical solutions for managing your life and career. I'm your host, Scott Ventrella. We've been speaking with Nick Perna, the everyman's economist. So Nick, that's kind of catchy. Is that will that be your new tagline?
I'm going to use that. Yeah, great.
I noted earlier in the show that Nick graduated from Boston College. He has a PhD in economics from MIT. He's also taught at Williams College, NYU Stern School of Business, and the Haas School of Business at the University of California, and currently teaches a seminar on the U.S. banking system at Yale. So, incredibly prestigious, well-known schools, and very expensive. So I mentioned that because I'm thinking, okay, now we won't get into when you graduated from BC and MIT,
right.
It was at least a few years ago. And when you think about the costs, and you think about the places where you have taught recently and currently are teaching, my gosh, when you think about even your own education, have things really gotten out of control, or is it the same as our earlier discussion about inflation, that it is pretty much kept up with regular inflation and that kind of thing?
That's a well-phrased question, because this is one of the areas that has beat inflation by a wide margin on a sustained basis. By that I mean, no matter what the inflation rate is, 5% overall, 3% overall, college tuitions managed to rise a couple points faster every year. You start accumulating this over 15, 20, 30 years, and you get $55,000 a year, okay, or whatever it costs.
That's the number. And you know what's interesting is that when our kids were born, we started a college fund, and we started putting money away, and we thought, okay, we ought to have this thing licked. Well, it's amazing, by the way, and I know you have grown kids. It's amazing how quickly those 17 years goes.
Yeah, and you would have had to have been really lucky to kind of get the returns to even keep up with the rate of inflation for college tuitions, much less beat it.
So as we are now looking at schools and receiving, letters and things like that, it was a shocker for me because, I can reconcile the fact that the Harvards, the MITs, the Yales, et cetera, are going to be 50 plus, even into the 60s. But what I'm shocked at is, the school, every private school, and these are not the top tier Ivy Leagues, they're all 55,000 or more. We're not prepared to write. We've got two kids. We're not prepared to write $200,000 checks for each kid. That's close to $500,000. So yeah. What kind of advice would you selfishly give a guy like me?
Yeah, it's really tough. And I think there are only a couple of things that can be done, especially you're on the cusp of sending one of them imminently and the other one in a little while, right?
That's correct.
So the only kinds of things you can do is say, is there a way of cutting the cost by, for example, can my daughter get through in 3 years instead of 4? Okay. Can she take courses in the summertime instead of taking a job that pays minimum wage? Can she, and if for the younger one, if there's time, can he take some AP courses, advanced placement courses, that will reduce the amount of time he has to spend in college? So one thing I think, especially if your kids are a little bit younger and you can plan, is to see if you can get them on the 3-year plan instead of the 4, or better than, you know, or at least keep them off the 5- and 6-year plan, okay? So that's one thing, and I've heard of parents actually doing it and sharing some of the gains with their kids.
Oh, I think my kids would love that.
Yeah. Now, the other thing is, you know, is it possible to say, all right, let me for the first year or two, I'm going to go to the local state college or even a community college, all right? And then I'm going to transfer into the school that I really want to go to. But in the meantime, I'm going to live at home and save. I mean, granted, it's a compromise, but, you know, it's either pay me now or, I mean, what's going to happen is if you try to foot the bill for $500,000, you're going to be either fully depleted or the kids are going to have loan burdens that are going to be impossible. And there are ways. And again, transferring is a viable option, especially if you do well.
And you never want to see your kids start, you know, graduate and then have that incredible debt that they have to deal with. Nor do I hear you suggesting, though, that we take equity from our house or tap into 401k.
Well, no, I mean, a 401k is dangerous because what are you going to do? I mean, you know, you're young, but still, old age creeps up on you quick.
Yeah.
And equity, if you've got it, yeah. I mean, the problem is with house prices down in this area, maybe, I don't know, 25% or 30%, most of us don't have a ton of equity left, you know, unless you've been around like I have for so many years. But if you do have it, I think it's a reasonably efficient way of borrowing money.
No, I think those are excellent tips and, quite frankly, not things that I've been thinking about. Would you then also suggest that the child participates in this kind of a conversation? We've got 1 minute to go. Would you suggest that we engage in dialogue with our children around this topic?
Yes. In fact, if you sat down and said, well, look, if you go here to $55,000 a year, here's what's going to end up being your indebtedness when you get out and how you're going to have depleted my retirement when you get out. But if we try this other option, then your indebtedness will be less, my retirement will be better, and you'll have enough left over to put the down payment on a nice little car.
I think that, you know, that could be a very viable solution and very practical as well, which is what at least it's been very helpful to me, and I think also for many of our listeners. We've been speaking with Nick Perna, economist. Nick, thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Likewise. You ask great questions.
Well, thank you. And thank you for joining me today. Remember, you only have one life. Why not live it on purpose? This is Scott Ventrella for the Business of Living Show. So long.